From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Washington should declare moral bankruptcy, says Arianna Huffington. WorldCom, Enron, Tyco, they are just the tip of a very large iceberg of corruption and Washington complicity being perpetuated by what Huffington shouts is a greed-driven corporate class wildly out of whack with the core values of the American people. This hour, On Point, Arianna Huffington and the hijacking of American democracy. We begin with the cold, hard facts on the U.S. economy. Forget about the weather. It's the economy that's in the real deep freeze. Weak earnings and war fears fueled heavy sell-offs on Washington this week. The Dow was down another 238 points today, and there's little optimism in a quick rebound. Greg Ipp is economics reporter with the Wall Street Journal. I asked him to assess the stock market skid this week and its economic backdrop.
Well, Tom, the Iraq war situation has lately become kind of a kitchen sink excuse for everybody who wants to say why they're feeling lousy and the economy's not doing well. I don't think there's any question that fear that we'll have a war and oil prices will shoot higher is probably a problem out there. I'm beginning to wonder, though, Tom, if there's not a lot else going on. I still think that we're dealing with the after effects of the collapse of one of the biggest bubbles in U.S. history. Mm-hmm. People are poorer, and companies' equity has been wrecked, and there has just been enormous pressure for people to spend less and invest less and rebuild their savings. And frankly, that's what we're continuing to see. A lot of companies in the last few weeks have come out with their earnings reports, and the announcements have not been terribly encouraging. Intel came out and said to expect not such a great year, and not only that, they were going to cut their own capital spending budget fairly heavily. You saw banks take major write-offs on their loan portfolios last year, and these are the sort of things that are driving the stock market down. And so after a few very strong days at the beginning of the year, we're back into negative territory.
We spent much of last year waiting for that promised recovery. Is it on the horizon yet? Is it with us?
Tom, I think the recovery is here and it's still going on. It may be so faint that you can barely detect it, but I actually do think it's here. The economy does continue to grow. We've seen things such as housing starts, for example, were very strong in December. The construction sector is doing well. There was a big jump in automobile sales in December, which shows that people do still respond to incentives. And as we move into the month of January, there are reasons to believe that things are on the mend. The number of people filing their first claims for unemployment insurance has trended lower. But that said, I'd be kidding you if I said that there weren't a lot of flies in that ointment. We've had some very unsettling reports. For example, the number of jobs went down in December. The level of industrial production went down in December. Some of these are sort of fluky things because the statistics are always tough to read because of all the seasonal influences around this time of year. All that said, it does suggest that we ended the year on a very weak note.
Does that mean, Greg Ipp, that we're still teetering between growth and recession?
I wouldn't go so far as to say teetering, but I certainly wouldn't say that a dip back in recession is a zero possibility. It's probably at least 25%, maybe a little bit higher. But I think to force us back in, we'd need a much bigger negative shock from something. And that something could be, for example, a much worse outcome in the Mideast situation than we've currently priced in. Oil is already over $33 a barrel. If it went over $40 a barrel, that would deal a really big blow both to corporate profit margins and to people's spending power. So that could definitely significantly raise the odds. But absent that kind of shock, Tom, I think we continue to muddle through. Consumers have shown that as long as they have the money, they will tend to spend it.
So at that point, how does the stock market's health and the economy's health, how do these two interact with each other? The war sits there as an unknown. It could go well. It could go poorly. How are the economy and stock market playing off one another now?
Well, the last two or three years, the big drop in the stock market has a major factor in terms of depressing economic activity through two channels, really. One is it makes people poorer, so they spend less to rebuild their savings. Mm-hmm. And the other is that it makes it harder for companies to issue a stock, and they need to do that sometimes to invest. So it hit us both on the consumer side and on the business side. Now, the stock market is about 40% below its highs of 2000. Unless it drops another 70%, and I frankly don't know of anybody predicting that, you're not going to get a repeat of the same negative shock. All it really needs to do is sort of hang in around these levels, maybe with a fair bit of volatility, and eventually people will get used to the current levels of wealth that they have, and things will recover. And I don't see why we shouldn't have that kind of situation. And the other thing that is a bit encouraging, Tom, is that even though the level of the stock market's been going down, it hasn't been going down with the signs of fear and panic that were rampant 2 or 3 months ago. If you look at the bond market, for example, which is a little less familiar to most people but is nonetheless very important, you see that people who buy and sell bonds aren't betting that half of America is about to go bankrupt in the next year, which is sort of how the market was behaving 3 or 4 months ago. That's another encouraging sign.
There's also a dance going on now between the stock market and the U.S. dollar. How do those two interact?
The dollar, of course, people have been saying for years that the dollar was a bit like the NASDAQ. It was overvalued and just ready for a fall. And who knows, maybe like the NASDAQ, the day has finally come. It's off significantly against the euro in the last week or two. And that's partly because we've been borrowing too heavily from foreigners for many years, and eventually they get tired of that and don't want to lend us anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it'll have two impacts, the weaker dollar. One would be very positive. As the dollar goes down, it means that companies in the United States that sell overseas, or for that matter, who sell in the United States but against foreign competitors, will get a leg up, because it means that foreigners' costs have gone up, and it means that Americans can sell for lower prices in foreign markets. That will be good for exports, good for growth, it'll be good for profits. There's a possible negative. If the people who own tens of billions of dollars of U.S. stocks and bonds fear that the dollar is going into free fall, they may head for the exits en masse and start dumping these things left, right, and center.
That is pulling out of the U.S. stock market.
Yeah, you might see foreigners just flee the U.S. stock and bond markets in waves, and that would send stock prices tumbling, and it would very perversely send interest rates up, and that is definitely something we don't need right now. That said, Tom, I don't think it's happening now, and I don't think it's going to happen. And in fact, in the last week, when we've had the dollar fall so sharply against the major currencies, bond yields have gone down.
How much influence can Washington have over all this? President Bush steps up to the podium for his State of the Union speech next week. Can he change the psychology, change the direction of the economy or the market with that speech?
I don't think there's much doubt that the Congress and the president could make a big impact on economic growth this year with the right type of fiscal stimulus. I'm not convinced, and the markets aren't convinced, that the president's package, as it currently stands, is really what the economy needs right now. Even by the president's own estimates, that's only going to add about 0.2% to growth this year, and that'll all come, really, in the second half of the year because it takes so long to adjust things like taxes.
So what would Wall Street prefer to see?
They would much rather see a lot of the money front-loaded to the earlier part of the year. They would like to see more of it go directly into areas where it'll be spent right away. For example, aid to the states and the local governments, who, as you've probably heard, are really, really hurting. They're laying off civil servants and cutting back spending on higher education and so forth to deal with serious deficits.
And would Wall Street prefer that, even if it meant it didn't get the big long-run tax breaks that the president's plan entails?
At this point, Wall Street would just like to see some kind of action, I think, of any kind. And Wall Street would also like to see corporate America start reporting some better profit numbers. And quite frankly, I can't think of any fiscal stimulus package which is going to do much for profit margins in the next 6 or 7 months. But that said, if investors got the feeling that the economy was pulling solidly out of its slump and that fiscal policy was giving us a very high added degree of insurance that was going to happen, I think that would be very positive in terms of keeping stock prices where they are, if not bringing us back to the glory days of 99.
But they're not feeling it yet. Greg Ipp, thanks for joining us tonight.
Tom, it's always a pleasure.
Greg Ipp is economics reporter with the Wall Street Journal. He spoke with us earlier from Washington. Think of America as a house divided horizontally. Upstairs, says Arianna Huffington, reside the corporate titans with their wildly inflated salaries and gold-plated everything, lavish parties, private jets, robber baron opulence, all paid for, she says, by hapless investors who were essentially robbed blind. Downstairs sits the rest of America, poor souls left in the lurch, struggling to get by, to pay the bills, to send kids to college on a worthless portfolio, to rebuild for retirement. In her new book, Pigs at the Trough, How Corporate Greed and Political Corruption Are Undermining America, Huffington says corporate titans have bushwhacked democracy. Americans, she says, should forget about real change coming from a deeply compromised Washington. Those federal promises to clean up corporate America have holes big enough to fly a private jet through. Big money is still in America's driver's seat, Huffington warns, and the rest of America is out in the cold, betrayed by the rich and powerful, betrayed, she says, by the market itself. Do you buy the Huffington diagnosis? Is it as bad as all that? Are you ready to throw in the towel on the wonders of the free-for-all market? Do you see a better way? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Philadelphia is Arianna Huffington, nationally syndicated columnist, political commentator, and author of the new book, Pigs at the Trough, How Corporate Greed and Political Corruption Are Undermining America. Good evening and welcome, Arianna Huffington.
Good evening. Thank you so much. Can you come around the country with me doing readings from the book? It sounds very dramatic.
Well, you've sharpened the spurs to a pretty high gleam in this one, Arianna, and you start right there with the title, Pigs at the Trough. It's not bulls and bears anymore in your universe. It's just pigs. Why pigs?
Well, because that behavior, and when I referred to that behavior, I'm not just talking about the CEOs, but about the politicians as well, is piggish. There is no other description for it. I mean, the point that you started the show with, the discrepancies, the disparities between a small elite at the top and the majority of Americans is really at the heart of the book. Because when you have, in one decade between 1990 and 2000, average CEO pay rise by 571%, while average worker pay rose by 37%. Something has gone very wrong, especially since at the very moment that they were getting these huge salaries, bonuses, stock options, multi-billion dollar quote-unquote loans, they're also bankrupting their companies. So there isn't even any connection between success and lavish reward, which is what at least Ayn Rand would have admired. This is the free market ran amok.
But you know, as well as we do, Arianna Huffington, at the beginning of that decade, there was an enormous amount, well, maybe not the beginning, because we had a recession then, but by the middle of the decade, there was huge anticipation that a post-Cold War free market globally would unlock productivity and prospects for all citizens on a scale we'd never, ever seen before. Why shouldn't that have been the case? Why shouldn't it still be the case?
Because that was exactly the bipartisan betrayal of the American people that I'm talking about. It wasn't just Republicans, it was new Democrats who bought that illusion that the quote-unquote democratization of capital would really spread everywhere, that everything would trickle down. Basically, everybody had become a trickle-down Reaganite by the mid-90s.
Well, but was it really trickle-down? Everyone was jumping into the pool. I mean, everybody owned stock. People were starting companies right and left and center. There was a lot of energy in the air in addition to what turned out to be a lot of fraud in the air. Why shouldn't that work?
Well, you mean why didn't it work?
Well, I guess I mean two things. Why didn't it work is one question, and why shouldn't it work looking ahead? Nobody wants to go back to an old welfare society. You yourself were way off that bandwagon a long time ago.
No.
So
absolutely not. But I mean, okay, let's talk theory first. Right now, our democracy is so driven by corporate backers and lobbyists that I say in the book that we're really on autopilot. It doesn't matter what politicians say, what bills they pass, like the Sarbanes bill that passed. We see 2 days ago on the front page of the New York Times that the SEC has already either killed or watered down these new rules to such an extent that they are practically meaningless. So when I say a ship on autopilot, just imagine a little boy trying to steer the ship of state. And by using the steering wheel, it doesn't really matter what the little boy does. It doesn't really matter what politicians are saying. This ship is on autopilot.
And what's
We're
the
going
course setting?
In that direction.
What setting are
the
we locked into is, that's got you so hot under the collar?
We are locked into doing the bidding of the corporate interests that have the hundreds of lobbyists in Washington, D.C. and in many state capitals. And if you want some evidence, what was the first act of the 108th Congress? Restricting lobbying rules. Mm-hmm. So now
Send
in the midnight feast. And first of all, I want to know, how come the lobbies know who is working late and when? Why are they so chummy? You know, do the politicians and their staffers call their wife first to say, honey, I'm not coming home for dinner. And then they call their lobby saying, I want my filet mignon on the rare side. It's that chumminess between the lobbyists and the politicians that constantly is undermining the public interest.
And you're saying to the point now where it is divisive, the story of the 90s, the story now is an anti-democratic tale of two Americas.
Exactly, because right now, basically, it's so clear that the game is rigged. It's like some shady ring toss booth on a carnival midway. And if the playing field isn't level, then the market isn't free, and then this is not a truly democratic society.
We're going to be looking at that tonight. Arianna Huffington, if you can stand by, we've got to take a short break. We are talking with Arianna Huffington about the causes and implications of an upstairs, downstairs America. You can join the conversation. Do you see, does your America, your reality, do you see it in the picture that Arianna Huffington paints here? Are you ready to throw in the towel on the wonders of the market? Well, for all its flaws, is the market still America's great engine? Join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with nationally syndicated columnist and political commentator Arianna Huffington about the themes of her new book, Pigs at the Trough, about the causes and implications of an upstairs, downstairs America. You can join the conversation. What is America if not market-driven? And have American economics put American democracy in peril? What's the way forward here? Not back to Enron or necessarily FDR. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Arianna Huffington, you quote Franklin Delano Roosevelt compellingly in the introduction to your book. You quote him saying, "We have always known that heedless self-interest was bad morals. We know now that it is bad economics in the long run. Economic morality pays." So FDR kicks off your book, but how far back in time, how far back in our understanding of economics and regulation do you want us to go here?
Well, you know, in my younger days when I was studying economics at Cambridge, which was a very Keynesian university, we were taught right at the beginning that Adam Smith, you know, the founder of free market economics, before he wrote The Wealth of Nations, he wrote The Theory of Moral Sentiments. The point of that being that you cannot have a capitalist society based on the free market if the moral values of that society have run amok. And this is really what happened here. And it's the obvious excesses of the CEOs is one thing, but it's excesses of CEOs at the very moment when they were actually destroying their companies. So that is what is kind of unique in what's happening now and in the extent to which it's happening. And also the fact that even now, even after we've seen, we have Eliot Spitzer, the Attorney General of New York, who started as a crusader, caving in, blinking, whatever term you want to use.
Caving in and blinking. He gets a lot of big headlines saying Eliot Spitzer, crusader.
Okay, but just look at the settlement he's about to sign with Wall Street. Not a single one of those guys is being indicted. Jack Grubman, who was caught red-handed with his emails about the AT&T rating he was giving because he wanted his kids to get into an elite school
in
Manhattan. Yeah, all those things that we have them there in black and white. How often do you get that stuff in black and white, right? Nevertheless, this guy is getting away with a fine. Mike Milken should really be upset. At least he went to jail. These guys, nobody has been indicted. Nobody's going to jail. I'm talking about Wall Street. Some people will go to jail in corporate America. But the worst part, the part that is about our moral values, is that nobody has had to admit wrongdoing. Now, that is at the heart of living in two Americas. If you were a common criminal, you would have to admit wrongdoing before any kind of plea bargain negotiations could begin, but not if you are a big enough criminal in terms of defrauding the public.
And as a result, you say that the modern social contract, the hard-fought consensus that emerged since the New Deal, has been shredded. But, of course, this was a bipartisan effort. I mean, Ronald Reagan may have kicked it off. I'd be interested to know where you think it begins. But Bill Clinton was right in the middle of this. And you quote him standing in Davos saying that the job of a new generation was to persuade people that democracy and free markets can give all people the opportunity to live out their dreams. An awful lot of Americans bought that and buy it. What is the alternative?
Well, the alternative is to have some oversight, to have government as a watchdog. It's nothing new. It's just that it hasn't happened. Indeed, during the 90s, we dismantled a lot of the regulations that had been put in place since the New Deal. And that's really what the problem is in terms of the institutional frameworks that have been put in place to protect us from the greed, the pathological greed of corporate executives.
So you're drawing a distinction between free markets and market economics. You want something a bit more trussed up and cosseted than a free market.
Well, first of all, we don't have a free market. That's a joke. You know, we have a market absolutely loaded with corporate welfare. We have a market where if somebody is a big enough contributor with big enough lobbying clout, they get what we want. Take what we did with steel. Despite the free market credentials and free trade credentials of this administration, we are ending up protecting through billions of dollars of corporate welfare, the all dysfunctional steel industries in this country, not for any other reason except that they had very powerful lobbyists and they were major campaign contributors. So I can give you endless examples of how this market is not free, except in theory.
Yes, you do, and you do it in the book. You talk about a bloodless coup, about what you call a corporate takeover of democracy. What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that our democracy right now dictates public policy that is not in the public interest. I mean, let me give you an obvious example that's been in the news recently. The massive tax loophole that allows people who buy particularly large gas-guzzling SUVs to get a major tax deduction through depreciation. And now the administration wants to make it even bigger. I mean, how does that make any sense?
I mean, if a small business is leasing an SUV or a Hummer or something.
Or buying it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. They can get two-thirds of it immediately depreciated, which means that if they buy a $47,000 vehicle, they can basically use as a tax credit over $30,000.
But that's a bloodless coup. That's a corporate takeover of democracy. That sounds like an ugly wrinkle in a tax code. Not a coup.
No, this is just a small. Now, what I'm saying is this is a small example of something which is so absolutely, straightforwardly against the public interest, nevertheless, is in the books and remains in the books because Detroit is so much more powerful than the public. Until the public gets outraged, and that's where I want to disagree with something you said earlier, there is nothing in my book that suggests that we should throw in the towel. On the contrary, I'm saying that we should stop waiting for political leaders on white horses to save us. We need to sort of assume a leadership position ourselves and provide the kind of populist outrage that can bring about change and has already brought about some changes, even though they're being constantly undermined.
But like the throwing in the towel that I was referring to there was my reading, that you're saying just about let's throw in the towel on the market as the dynamic engine of this economy. You say it's time for the shoppers to leave the malls and take to the streets. But what's the embracing philosophy that they embrace in the street?
Well, no, when I say take to the streets, I mean reassert the rights that we all have to live in one nation, not in two nations. And that's what I mean by the hijacking of democracy.
Can we have powerful economic growth with the kind of regulation, the kind of tighter oversight that you're describing?
Absolutely. I mean, would you like to see a repetition of what we had in the 90s with this huge bubble bursting? Do you know how much suffering has been caused? I'm sure you do. This was
Of course. It's no secret, and you outline a ton of it. On the other hand, we looked across the pond and talked about eurosclerosis for much of the 90s and the 80s, saw growth rates there that did not match American growth rates. They're still working out problems. Is that the answer, a kind of European welfare democracy?
This is not either or. I mean, oversight and the end of corporate welfare that I'm talking about do not have to be stifling the U.S. economy. But without that kind of oversight, without some really strong watchdogs in the form of the SEC, and without some form of watchdog power in the form of strong independent corporate boards, how are we going to turn the page? I mean, from your early report on the show, it's clear that we have not turned the page.
We certainly haven't. And from your book and columns, it's clear that the reforms so far have not really gone deep. Arianna Huffington, a lot of people want to join this conversation. I want to turn to the phones, if you'll allow me. Mike is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Micah. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
First thing I'd like to say is your guest, I completely agree with her, and she's more on the economic side, and Ralph Nader is more on the democratic side. I'm reading his book right now, and she's saying exactly the same thing, and she's proving her point, and he proved his point a long time ago to me. And she also mentioned, which is what I was going to say, the invisible hand. In America, for capitalism to work properly and for democracy to work properly for people, they have to be separate. No more corporate welfare, period. She's right. I agree with her. There's a lot of us that agree with her. And I'm going to take my comments off the air.
Micah, thanks very much for your call. Arianna Huffington, you say, you ask, who will save the nation? You say, will it be a younger, charismatic Ralph Nader, a Ross Perot without the corporate baggage or bats in the belfry? You say no. You say it will be a critical mass of individuals and groups mobilized by injustice. That sounds like something that hasn't happened for a long time.
But I think this is a populist moment. And in the book, I give examples of that moment. And also, I give a long list of groups that are working in the trenches at the grassroots level that people can join.
Common Cause, Global Exchange, Center for Public Integrity, and so on.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And also, we have evidence just over the last couple of months of how this works. For example, just because the public was outraged, not because of anything the Democratic leadership did, Henry Kissinger is no longer heading the 9/11 commission.
Because he would not say who his clients were. It was more important to him to stick with them than with the nation there.
But it wasn't Tom Daschle who demanded that we see his client list. Mm-hmm. It was the people in the form of the bloggers on the internet, the chat rooms, the people protesting, the same with Trent Lott, the same with the president's proposal to reduce his proposed increase of the SEC budget. There was such outcry that he's ending up increasing the increase. So, I mean, there are so many examples of how outrage taking action work, and that's really what I'm saying. It's just that we need to do it in a concentrated way, and we only need a critical mass of people. It's never the majority. It's always a small strategic minority that changes.
And
things.
You think that minority can leverage the system back into a different position against the interests of wealth, of corporate interests, who, as you say, are spending billions on lobbyists in Washington?
First of all, I think nothing else will at the moment. Mm-hmm. And secondly, I think that one of the reasons that this can happen is because our politicians are particularly spineless right now. And because they're particularly spineless, they scare easily. Mm. So when they see the public outraged, that's the only thing that trumps the power of their corporate backers and with their lobbyists in Washington.
Arianna Huffington is waving the bloody shirt. Are you with her or again her? Laura's calling from Gay Mills, Wisconsin. Hi, Laura. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. And sure. Arianna, thank you so much for writing this book. I didn't know it existed till I heard about it tonight. But I agree with the last caller. I think you're speaking for a lot of people. What was called up in me by hearing what you're talking about tonight, I live in a small town right now, and I was raised in a large city, and I've learned a lot living here about probably what American capitalism was originally, which was, you know, it existed in small communities to keep a market healthy for how people needed to serve each other economically. Mm-hmm. And what's really wrong, as you say, it's the corporate. You know, you get the corporate out of there. And I guess where I come from is, you say talk about throwing the towel. I guess I have, because I feel that the best way to affect it is to not even try and do anything to the system as it exists, but to create another way. And in a way, I guess I think of it as going forward to, again, a small base for our markets.
Kind of back to the future. But, Laura, in an era when we hear constantly about the global village, can we avoid that kind of global intimacy or global market?
Oh, I think we can do it, too, though. I don't know if you've ever heard of a catalog called that. I don't know if they do it right now, but there's other organizations do called Pueblo to People.
I know that kind of thing. You're talking about handicrafts sold directly and so on. But
well, I mean, that's just that one thing. But what I'm saying is there's no reason in this world we live in now, the way the communications are, that very locally based economies and capitalists at that level can't be trading and marketing with each other in a true global market.
Arianna Huffington, join us.
But also, there is something else that's happening that can even happen at a global level, and that's called triple bottom lining. I don't know if you've heard about that. as opposed to just the simple bottom lining of profit and loss that most businesses are engaged in? What about also looking at the second bottom line, which is how the workers are treated in a particular factory or industry or service industry, and how the environment is affected? Basically, how we treat not just our shareholders, but our stakeholders. Now, this is not something as radical as you may think. There are companies that are practicing it right now in the United States and making large profits. And there are companies that actually are beginning to introduce in small areas like Starbucks and Nike. Now, some have been have taken the initiative themselves. Some have been forced by public pressure.
And yet, Arianna, it's a big, tough world out there, Arianna Huffington, with all kinds of competitors. What about Laura's notion? We hear more and more about this idea of kind of molecular culture, molecular economics, right down at the very small level. It sounds marvelous in a kind of handicraft way. Does that really have the stuff, though, to play as a support for the huge American economy and the kind of standard of living Americans expect?
Well, it's not going to replace the large economy, but I think it's a very legitimate choice that people can make. I mean, why not? What is so magnificent about an economy that is totally driven by advertising of drugs for everything, for example? I mean, in my book, I have a whole list, not just of the financial scandals, but of the scandals when it comes to our health and safety, the way that drug companies keep drugs on the shelves even after they've been proved to damage our health.
We grant you that big is not necessarily beautiful. Laura, thanks for your call. John's colleague from Cape Cod. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. A little bit different point. All of Bush's policies favor corporations. Indeed, he's the most corporate-centric president for a very long time. And we are being deceived. Bush gained office by deception. He was portrayed as a moderate, yet there was a plan in place, I'm convinced, to have him portrayed as a moderate, gain office, and then govern from the extreme right, help corporations. This deception ought to be exposed. There was a book, Selling the President in 1968, by Joe McGinnis, that told how Richard Nixon was packaged in a public relations campaign to be the new Nixon, something other than what he was. And that's
John, our time is running down before the break. I thank you for your observation. Arianna Huffington, lots of presidential candidates of all parties are packaged for sale. Do you see Bush as a particularly deceptively packaged item?
Well, what is particularly deceptive about Bush and Cheney is that here we have two oil men running the government who have not really been held accountable for what they did during their business career. And very quickly, when Cheney was in charge at Halliburton, the tax havens, the subsidiaries that were created to basically avoid paying taxes, went from 9 to 44, thereby ensuring that Halliburton went from paying taxes to getting a huge multi-million tax rebate. Now, that may be legal, but it should not be, and especially at a time of war, at a time when we are told again and again that we need to come together to protect the homeland. Why should it be okay for the vice president, when he was a CEO, to have led his company in a way that basically was unpatriotic?
Well, a question that has not necessarily been answered. Arianna Huffington, please stand by. We're talking tonight about the causes and implications of an upstairs, downstairs America. Do you buy the Huffington diagnosis? And what is our dynamic engine to be, if not a free market? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Arianna Huffington about the causes and implications of an upstairs, downstairs America. She's out with a new book with a tough title, not about bears and bulls, but Pigs at the Trough, How Corporate Greed and Political Corruption Are Undermining America. What do you think? Can you imagine going back to an FDR-style America? Have we really been on the wrong track since Reagan? Have American economics put American democracy in peril? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Arianna Huffington, you're very straightforward about the expectations that Americans were led to have post-Cold War in the 90s and before about what would result from a deregulated economy, a free economy, a globalized economy. And then you come down like a ton of bricks on what was actually produced. It might be instructive for us to look at your own political evolution over this last decade. I seem to remember you in Newt Gingrich's sidecar for a while there. You had your own walk on the conservative side. What took you there? What took you away from that?
Yes, absolutely. I think my own political evolution was really brought about by my own personal observation of what the Republican leadership was doing, and also by my own expectation that turned out to be wrong, that the private sector would step up to the plate and provide solutions to many of the social problems we're facing. Remember, that was the Newt Gingrich idea when he gave his speech, when he first became speaker. He said basically dealing with poverty is more important than balancing the budget. He quoted FDR. He talked about the responsibility of the private sector, but nothing happened. And when I personally tried to raise money for homeless shelters or abused children, I found out that it was much easier to raise money for the opera or fashionable museums. So basically, my political evolution was very simple and straightforward. It had to do with the role of government, because I was always a social moderate, you know, pro-choice, pro-gun control, pro-gay rights, so that there has been no change there. But I recognized that we need the raw power of government appropriations and government priorities to really address the major social problems we are facing, and that didn't happen in the booming 90s, and it's not happening now. Then the excuse was, not to worry, the free market will take care of everything. The free market will give you the money to get your health care and your children's education. And now the answer is, we don't have the money. We're facing a budget crisis, and you hear that from state capitals as well as from Washington, D.C.
And we're cutting taxes, so there will be less money. But you wrote in March of 2000, when you kind of announced or came out to explain this transformation, which had been underway for a while, you said, "The path I was searching for would take us beyond the standard left-right paradigm and provide new solutions." So have you found that path?
Yes. I did not go from being a Republican to being a Democrat. I went to a state of sort of disillusionment with both parties and tremendous hope as to what the people can achieve. You know, as Martin Luther King said, you don't start a movement, you prepare for a movement. And right now, all across the country, there are people preparing. You know, there are people organizing. And there are people making it clear that enough is enough. We cannot basically continue with a state of affairs where in the middle of growing unemployment, growing deficit, more and more people without health care, and on and on and on. The priority of this administration is to reduce and end, indeed, double taxation of dividends. I mean, even if you think that's a good thing, it's not the first thing.
But is it an evolutionary step you're looking for here, or a kind of revolutionary step? How close does your vision of where the country ought to be come to where it sits right now?
Well, I think there has to be a very fundamental shift in priorities. I want us to come to a place where it should not be acceptable that Jon Snow will be Treasury Secretary, since out of the four last years when he was CEO of his company, during three of those 4 years, they paid no taxes. Indeed, they got a tax rebate. It should not be acceptable that ordinary Americans are struggling to meet their tax obligations while big CEOs are defrauding the American public to the tune of $70 billion a year in tax havens, corporate welfare, more billions of dollars. And then, of course, the way they are using the so-called generally acceptable accounting principles, all the machinations of accountants and lawyers, which means that just about everything they do can be considered legal.
But it sounds like your prescription would bring American business as we know it to a screeching halt. I'm just trying to get a handle on it.
Absolutely not. What are you defending? You know, how can...
Defending, I'm asking, because it is, you're the one who's setting out how corrupt, how morbidly off base the system is now. You're describing something
But what I'm saying is that just because it's so corrupt and so fraudulent, it's not even working at the pure economic level, which is really the quote you read from FDR. It's not as if, okay, it's corrupt, it's fraudulent, but look at the growth it's producing. It's not anymore. That the bubble has burst. We can't go back to the illusions that drove the 90s.
We're looking for clarity to drive this decade. Amy's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Amy. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I agree with Arianna, and I wanted to thank her for her work and tell her that I admire her very much. I wanted to mention that I think one of the important things to recognize as undermining our very sovereignty as a country are things like NAFTA and these free trade agreements, where foreign corporations that do business in the United States are allowed to sue our government and have sued our government for billions of dollars in damages, when our laws, like discrimination and employment laws and environmental laws, supposedly cause these companies or corporations to lose profits. It's the ultimate undermining of our democracy, of our very sovereignty as a nation.
And taking apart workers' rights as it goes. But, Amy, let me ask you, do you believe, as Bill Clinton said in Davos not so long ago, that free trade, global trade, is the way to lift all boats?
Well, free is kind of a misnomer. I think the expression that we should be going after that other people use now is fair trade. Free, I mean, I don't think we should have trade without regulations. Then what's the purpose of having governments? Governments are supposed to be the way that people express their voices and opinions.
We hear you loud and clear. Arianna.
What Amy said is very important. I write about it in the book, what's happening through NAFTA, the way our sovereignty is undermined by these international treaties, and the way that our own priorities, you know, whether we care about the environment or the health of our workers, is being undermined by those treaties. And remember, this treaty was a bipartisan treaty, and that's really why I keep going back to that.
So, but what are you suggesting, that we shouldn't have free trade treaties, or that this treaty was crafted under a kind of regime that cared more about irresponsible freedom than the opposite?
I'm saying the second. And again, this administration is tossing aside its so-called free trade principles if it serves it, as it did with steel, as it's done with big agricultural concerns. And this is at the expense of third world countries that need our markets to export their own agricultural goods. So, I mean, the inhumanity of our policies, you know, is exemplified, of course, by what we did in Africa when we sided with the drug manufacturers and that were suing South Africa so that it could not import generic AIDS drugs as people were dying. And it took AIDS activists, 200 of them, demonstrating at Al Gore rallies to begin to change that policy. That's really what I'm asking for.
You write about the binge and the reckoning, the chickens coming home to roost, and you quote Plato from the Republic saying the greatest price of refusing to participate in politics is being governed by your inferiors. Well, you're pointing in a lot of directions at once there, Arianna Huffington.
Yes. You know what? As well as quoting Plato and FDR, come on, tell our listeners that the book is funny. I try to be humorous. I try to have a lot of fun sidebars. I try to use satire so that it's not didactic, but it draws the reader in. And actually, one of my favorite sidebars is the one that's called All in the Family, that points out just how many lobbyists are actually related to senators and congressmen.
Including some named Daschle, not just Republicans.
Exactly, like Linda Daschle, a chief lobbyist for the American Airlines, instrumental in the huge multi-billion bailout of the airline industry right after September 11.
Oh, I'll fully hand it to you. It's loaded front to back with kind of hair-raising examples of the worst of excess and a pretty provocative thesis running right along underneath that. All right, Anna Huffington, we are out of time, but I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Arianna Huffington is author of the new book, Pigs at the Trough, How Corporate Greed and Political Corruption Are Undermining America. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Just click on Forums. In a moment, a tribute to Super Bowl Sunday. This is On Point. You don't have to be a football fan to know that Sunday is the Super Bowl. This year's combatants are the Oakland Raiders and Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Time for chips and salsa, zillion-dollar ads, glitzy performances, and maybe a little football. The Super Bowl is now a commercial super stage for corporate America. But in this radio diary, writer Charlie Pierce says there's still a reason for us regular folk to gather round the television for the big game.
We are the empire of Ballyhoo, the universe of whiz-bang. There is no event, no matter how small or whispery it begins, that we cannot turn into a full-throated bellows. There's no one, no matter how pale or diffident, that we cannot turn into a marching band. We are a nation of brawling celebration. If the nativity had been held here, the Magi would have found their way by the light of the fireworks, the sound of the brass section, the smell of barbecue, and the trail of watermelon seeds on the ground. The star never would have stood a chance. Small wonder, then, that we have turned a football game, one usually played by talented men gone gray in their fingertips with tension, into the loudest and most everlastingly American of holidays. That it happens of a Sunday is something I suspect we'll all have to explain to whoever it is in the hereafter in charge with the enforcement of the third commandment. However, for the past XXX odd years, the country has come to a stop over this game the way it never came to a stop over any other. In the past, there were important games. The World Series riveted the nation, but it riveted the nation while the nation was still at its workaday life. Stockbrokers waited for the news on the radio while ironworkers stopped by the telegraph office on the way home. There were prize fights and horse races. But every Super Bowl is as born to be epic as a Plantagenet was to be king or a Manning to be a quarterback. It looms, huge and solid and invulnerable, at the end of every football season, and it's the only single game we have of which the competing teams are the least important element of all. The place is more important. San Diego is a nice spot, warm, friendly, and possessed of both performing sea mammals and easy access to the flesh pots of borderland Mexico, where other kinds of mammals have been known to perform. Cold weather spots are not encouraged, which is why, no matter how much it might have helped our nation heal, there was as much chance of the Super Bowl being played in New York as there was of one being played on the moons of Neptune. The exception that proves this rule is Detroit, which will be hosting its second Super Bowl in a couple of years, despite being both colder than New York and less fun than the moons of Neptune. The commercials are more important than the teams, else how would media business writers deduct their chips and dip? The Budweiser Frogs found their voice at the Super Bowl. That Ayn Randy and IBM ad was a highlight a few years back. At the only Super Bowl I attended in person, I was party to a press conference held on behalf of Spuds McKenzie, the famous beer spokesdog. Spuds, alas, appeared to be stoned to the eyeballs on Doggy Downers. Of course, that same Super Bowl was highlighted by a riot at Miami's Overtown section, touched off by a police shooting. All weekend long, the opulent buffet stretched until dawn while the ghetto burned. It's not often that one gets to feel like one of the end-stage Romanovs, but for me, that weekend was it. It was through the Super Bowl that the final marriage between the business of American sports and the business of American business was consummated. Now, every major sports event is little more than a plaything for the corporate class. In 1989, the year of my Super Bowl, with Spuds McKenzie and the Overtown riots, a squadron of private jets left Washington after the inauguration of the first President Bush and flew to Miami. These were two stops on the same Plutocrats Over America tour. That tour has grown now to include the World Series, college basketball's Final Four, the major college football bowl games, the Daytona 500, and every major golf and tennis tournament. So small wonder that those of us without private jets have carved out a holiday for ourselves in our homes. A yearly ritual with sacramental long necks and an endless communion of nachos. It is loud, it's noisy, and in the great grand scheme of things, it's probably pointless. But it's ours, damn it. And if there's anything more American than the ability to say that out loud, I don't know what it is. So make me a brass band. Throw me a parade. We're all worth at least one shout, I think.
Charlie Pierce is a staff writer for the Boston Globe magazine and a regular contributor to Esquire magazine and NPR's Only a Game. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBU.